best homemade pies, using freshly fallen fruit from the trees in her backyard. Her survival meant she was around when her little sister needed help. At the time my dad walked out on my mom, Pearl's nephew Randy said, there was nobody left, nobody to help us. And so Pearl and Hobart were the best people in our lives. They would take care of us. Another dial painter who came to the Argonne Laboratory was Marie Rossiter. She had survived to see her son, Bill, marry the girl next door, Dolores, and to see her granddaughter, Patty, grow up to become a dancer. Although for much of her life Marie had huge and spotty legs from the radium, which forced her to walk with a limp, she would dance with Patty regardless. She'd always dance with me, remembered her granddaughter fondly. It wasn't that great, but we danced together. She had a wonderful love for life. I used to look upon her like she could do anything. Marie simply refused to let the radium rule her life. She was in pain, recalled Dolores, pain to walk, pain to just stand here sometimes. It was that bad. Yet, although Marie had her bad times, I prayed to die and couldn't die, she once said. Why would I want to live? I had so much pain. She added, stoically, I witnessed the bad times, but you get through them. There was a friend of hers who had gotten through the bad times, too, Charlotte Purcell. She'd been told in the 1930s that she was the Ottawa dial painter most likely to die after Catherine Donahue. But 30 years later, she was still living. Marie Rossiter put that down to God's intervention, suggesting that he had helped Charlotte, spared her life, because Charlotte had, in turn, helped Catherine. Charlotte had had a sarcoma back in 1934, but her courage in electing to have an amputation undoubtedly saved her life. She lost all her teeth and had one leg shorter than the other, but, like Marie, she refused to let it bring her down. I now feel fine, although I'm bothered a bit by arthritis, she said to a reporter in the 1950s. I've gone through all that years ago. I don't like to think about it. Although it was a time in her life she wanted to forget, when the scientists invited her to Argonne, she answered their call. The doctors had told her that doing so would help others, and Charlotte Purcell was never a woman to turn down an appeal for aid. The research at Argonne uncovered what happened to the Ottawa women's lawsuits after Catherine Donahue won her test case. Many fought on with Grossman's help after that victory in court, though the small pot of money available meant the payouts were not high. Those who did claim were paid only a few $100 each. Charlotte received $300, $5,000, a negligible sum that made Al Purcell very angry. It paid for the amputation of her arm, and that was about it. Others received nothing. Marie was taken to lunch when she went to Argonne and said, "This is the most we'll probably ever get." Some dropped their cases. The Glachinsky sisters and Helen Munk were among them. Perhaps they'd joined forces for Catherine, and upon her death, the fight went out of them. There was very little money, anyway. Maybe, in the end, it did not seem worth it. It was the judgment they had fought for, and that they had achieved. As for the companies, eventually the law caught up with them, though by then the damage had been done. In 1979, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, found that the former USRC site in Orange had unacceptable, environmentally hazardous levels of radioactivity, 20 times higher than was safe. There was widespread contamination, and not just of the site, but in those locations where the company had dumped its radioactive waste as landfill. Almost 750 homes had been built on top of that waste. They, too, needed decontamination. More than 200 acres of land were affected in Orange, some to a depth of more than 15 feet. The EPA ordered the corporate successor of USRC to perform the cleanup work, but it declined, except for agreeing to erect a new security fence. Even this they did not see through. The EPA was forced to complete it. The courts were not forgiving. In 1991, the New Jersey Supreme Court found USRC forever liable for the contamination and declared the firm had had constructive knowledge about the dangers at the time it operated there. Residents sued the firm. After 7 years, the cases were eventually settled out of court, costing the company some $14.2 million, almost $24 million, in damages. It reportedly cost the government $144 million, $209 million, to clean up radium-contaminated sites across New Jersey and New York. As for Radium Dial, despite the wartime boom, it went bust in 1943. The building it left behind in the center of Ottawa, however, had a legacy that lasted far beyond that. A meat locker company later operated in its basement. Its employees died of cancer, while a family who purchased meat there found that every brother got colon cancer within 6 months of each other. The building itself was knocked down in 1968. "They just hauled it down," remembered Peg Looney's niece, Darlene, "and used it as fill everywhere." The waste from the building was dumped around town, including alongside a school field. Later studies showed an above-average cancer rate near the factory, as well as across town. People found that their pet dogs didn't live to maturity, and that the local wildlife developed distressing tumors. "I noted," said another niece of Peg, "that nearly one person in each household of that neighborhood where I grew up had cancer." Another resident remarked, "There aren't many families not affected." Yet the town officials, in a reprise of their attitude toward Catherine and her friends, did not address the evident problem. When filmmaker Carol Langer made a documentary, Radium City, which highlighted the town's radioactivity, the mayor declared, "That lady is trying to destroy us." He ordered everybody not to go to see it. "Well," said Marie's daughter-in-law Dolores, "that was the wrong thing to say, because it filled up the whole showing, and they had to have another one." The film was shown to a standing-room-only crowd of nearly 500 residents. "People were divided," recalled Darlene. "There were people that didn't want to hear about it. They didn't want to believe it. And then there were people who were like, 'Okay, let's get this cleaned up.'" In the end, they did get it cleaned up. The EPA stepped in, and funds were found to begin tackling the dangerous legacy of radioactivity that Radium Dial left Ottawa. As in Orange, the damage plunged many feet deep into the earth. It was an operation that would take decades. In 2015, the cleanup was still going on. The Center for Human Radiobiology, CHR, studied the Dial painters for decades. Its scientists came to learn that radium was a wily, tenacious element. With a half-life of 1,600 years, it had plenty of time to make itself known in those it had infiltrated, inflicting its own special damage across the decades. As the researchers followed the women through the years, they witnessed what the long-term effects of internal radiation really were. The Dial painters who had survived did not escape unscathed, far from it. Some women were stricken early, but then endured a half-life for decades. One Waterbury girl was bedridden for 50 years. The older the women were when they dial-painted, and the fewer years they worked, the less likely they were to die in the early stages. So they lived on, but the radium lived with them, a marriage from which there was no divorce. Many suffered significant bone changes and fractures. Most lost all their teeth. There were unusually large numbers who developed bone cancer, leukemia, and anemia. Some were given blood transfusions for years. The radium honeycombed the women's bones so that, for example, Charlotte Purcell later developed osteoporosis throughout her spine and suffered a partial collapse of her vertebrae. Like Grace Fryer before her, she ultimately wore a back brace. Marie Rossiter had at least 6 leg operations. Her swollen legs began turning black, and in the end, she had her leg amputated. "She said," remembered Dolores, "take it off, right now. I don't want to go home and think about it." Marie's remaining leg had a metal bar through it, from her knee to her ankle. She became crippled, but it still didn't slow her down. She was the life and soul of the care home she later lived in, whizzing about in her wheelchair. Having studied these long-term effects of radiation, the CHR scientists, who had at first been looking for a magic threshold of radiation exposure under which no harm was done, ultimately came to agree with Martland, who had warned decades before that the normal radioactivity of the human body should not be increased. It is impossible to say how many dial painters were killed by their work. So many were misdiagnosed or never traced that the records simply do not exist. Sometimes the cancer that former workers suffered later in life was never attributed to the job they did in their teens, though it came as a direct result. And the deaths, too, were only one part of it. How many women were crippled or suffered the unique pain of childlessness as a result of their poisoning is also unknown. The files at Argonne are filled with hundreds and hundreds of dial painters' names, or rather numbers. Each woman was given a reference number by which she was always known. The Argonne list of the doomed makes for chilling reading, charting, as it does, each woman's suffering with cool detachment. Bilateral amputations of both legs, amputation of right knee, died of cancer of ear, brain, hip, cause of death, sarcoma, 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 over and over through the files. Some women survived for 40 years or more, but the radium always came calling in the end. The newspapers followed some of the deaths. "Radium dormant killer at work again," screamed the headlines through the years. Mercedes Reed is said to have died in 1971. She was 86. "I'm absolutely, unequivocally convinced," said one researcher, "that the radium level would be huge in her bones. She supposedly died from colon cancer, but maybe it was misdiagnosed." The Reeds did not continue their association with Radium Dial, even before it went bust. Ultimately, Mr. Reed was fired from the plant, and it is understood that he was bitter about this, researchers discovered. After his dismissal from the company to whom he had been, some might say unforgivably loyal, he became a maintenance man for the YMCA. Reed's former president, Joseph Kelly, died about 1969 after a series of strokes reduced his mental capacity. He just got frailer and frailer. In his final years, he would often say, "Have you seen so-and-so lately?" of someone who had worked with him in the 1920s. Given his distance from the dial painters he had sentenced to death when he signed his name to the ad that told them they were safe, it seems unlikely his damaged mind was being haunted by the ghost girls. As for those girls he used to employ in Ottawa, against all the odds, a few of them had long, good lives. Pearl Payne lived to be 98 years old. She and Hobart embraced the extra time they had unexpectedly been given. "They traveled all over the world," revealed their nephew Randy. "They went to Jerusalem, England. They were in every state in the Union." Before she died, Pearl called Randy over to her house one day. "She asked me to go up in the attic and pick up some boxes and bring them down," he recalled. He picked his way through the items Pearl kept in her loft, a baby stroller, a crib. Strange things for an old lady to have in her attic, but perhaps Pearl had found herself unable to let go of these final traces of the many children she had wanted but could never have. Randy found the boxes she meant. They were full of newspaper cuttings about Catherine Donahue, and letters and documents to do with her case. "This is what happened to us," Pearl told Randy urgently, and she said emphatically, "These need to be safeguarded. This stuff is important. Be sure that Pearl, her daughter with the same name, gets these if anything happens to me." "Hobart and Pearl were two very fine people," said Randy. "I don't normally visit graves, but I go to theirs. And I want to tell you, I say thank you every time I'm there. That's the kind of people they were." Charlotte Purcell lived to be 82. She was adored by her grandchildren. "She was probably one of my most favorite people in the whole world," raved her granddaughter Jan. "She was one of the most courageous, loved, and influential people in my life. What my grandmother taught me was, it doesn't matter what life throws at you, you can adapt. When I asked her to teach me how to jump rope, she said, 'Well, I don't think I can teach you because I only have one arm.' I suppose that was upsetting to me, so she said, 'Well, wait.' She tied a rope to a chain-link fence, and then she jumped rope with one arm and showed me how to jump rope." Jan's brother Don added, "It was nothing out of the ordinary to me that she didn't have an arm because she made it that way." The kids would chorus, "Tell us the story of how you got your arm cut off." She would repeat the story, remembered Jan. She would repeat it over and over any time we asked. "When I was a young girl," Charlotte Purcell would say, "I got paid a lot of money to paint numbers on watches and clocks. We didn't know that the paint was a poison. After I had left there, my friend Catherine Donahue got very sick, and a lot of the girls started getting very sick. The poison settled in my arm, but with my friend Catherine it went throughout the body and she died. She died and left her husband and children without a mom. She was always pretty sad when she got to that part of the story. Though Charlotte had been unable to attend Catherine's funeral, her son remembered something from his mother's life that maybe, to a poetic mind, suggested that the friends got to say their own goodbye. 'When the weather was nice,' Donald recalled, 'my mother used to go out to the porch and sit on the glider they had there and swing back and forth. While she was there, a little yellow and black canary used to come and sit on her left shoulder, where her arm was missing, and might stay with her about 30 minutes and then leave. That happened several times. Normally, birds don't have anything to do with people.'" The women didn't talk to their families about the incredible legacy they had given the world, and the Radium Girls did not simply set safety standards and contribute incalculably to science. They left their mark in legislation, too, In the wake of Catherine Donahue's case in 1939, Secretary of Labor Frances Perkins announced that the fight was far from won when it came to workers' compensation. Subsequently, building on what the women had achieved in life, further legal changes were made to protect all employees. The Dial Painters case ultimately led to the establishment of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which now works nationally in the United States to ensure safe working conditions. Businesses are required to inform employees if they work with dangerous chemicals. Workers certainly won't be told that those corrosive elements will make their cheeks rosy. There are now processes for safe handling, for training, for protection. Workers also now have a legal right to see the results of any medical tests. To the Dial Painter's frustration, however, the results of the exams at Argonne were not shared with them. This secrecy may well have been to do with the highly technical nature of the measurements the researchers were making. Perhaps they thought the results would mean nothing to the women, but the women still wanted to know. They would never tell Marie anything, which made her mad, recalled Dolores. By 1985, after going there for decades, Charlotte Purcell had had enough of it. When the researchers called her that year, she said she had not been feeling well. "But why should I discuss it? You people don't help me. I don't get anything out of it. I don't even have any money to go to the doctor." She refused to go again. Marie did the same. And it wasn't just the scientists' silence that bothered her. It was her town's continued reaction to what the women had endured. She always thought the whole saga will be swept under the carpet. It will never come to light. You'll never hear about it. It made her shock all the greater when Carol Langer came to Ottawa to make her movie. Marie then remarked, "God has left me here. I always knew someone would walk through that door, and I would finally have a chance to tell my story." Langer dedicated the film to Marie, commending her for the way she had never lost her sense of humor or her faith, even as she'd battled against the toughest odds throughout her life. When Marie died in 1993, like many Dial Painters, she donated her body to science. "She thought maybe she could help other people," said her granddaughter, Patty. "Maybe they could find exactly what happened, and they could find a cure. Maybe she could help other women." Marie's body would not be the last Ottawa Dial Painter's corpse to be studied, nor was it the first. That honor goes to Margaret Looney. Peg's family had wanted her exhumed for testing as soon as they'd heard about the post-war studies on the Dial Painters. At that time, however, research was limited to the living. By the time CHR was established, the remit had broadened. Finally, someone was prepared to investigate what had really killed Peg. Every one of her 9 brothers and sisters signed the necessary forms. "It was going to help somebody else get better," said her sister Jean. "Of course we let them do it." In 1978, researchers exhumed Peg's body from the St. Columba Cemetery, where she had been resting alongside her parents. They discovered she had 19,500 microcuries of radium in her bones, one of the highest quantities found. It was more than 1,000 times the amount scientists then considered safe. They didn't just discover the radium. They discovered that the company doctor had cut her jawbone from her while she lay dead. That was probably how the Looney family found out about it. "I'm angry," said one of Peg's sisters. "They knew she was full of radium, and then they lied." "Every family has sadness and grief," Jean said steadily, "but Margaret's death was unnecessary." That was the tragedy. Radium had been known to be harmful since 1901. every death since was unnecessary. The researchers exhumed more than 100 dial painters, many tests proving once and for all that radium poisoning, and not syphilis or diphtheria, was the woman's true cause of death. And there was one deceased dial painter in particular in whom the scientists were very interested, Catherine Donahue. In 1984, CHR wrote to her daughter to request her exhumation. They wrote to Mary Jane because, by that time, Catherine's devoted husband Tom had died. He passed away on May 8, 1957, aged 62. He had lived the remainder of his life at 520 East Superior Street, never leaving the home he had once shared with Catherine, the home where, when the news of her triumph in court had come through, he and the family had celebrated with potluck food. "We all went down and we celebrated with him," remembered his niece, Mary, "because it was such a moral victory, something that nobody had ever done before. Though the money helped a lot, it couldn't bring Catherine back." "I think it broke him when she died," said a relative. "His heart was broken." The family rallied round. For a time, Tom's sister Margaret moved in to help with the children. Tom doted on the kids. "They were all he had left," Mary said simply. As time went on, she added, he healed. He became a smiling man. It was really great to see that. He rarely talked of Catherine, but, said Mary, it was a painful memory because of the painful death that she had. Tom Donahue never remarried. No one could replace Catherine Wolfe Donahue. As for Mary Jane's brother, Tommy, he had gone to fight in the Korean War and made it home. He married a young woman from Streeter and worked in a glass factory, just like his father. But he died shortly after his 30th birthday in 1963 of Hodgkin's disease, a type of cancer. Mary Jane had been on her own for a long time now. She had not had an easy life. The little girl who weighed only 10 pounds on her first birthday had stayed small. She was almost childlike, remembered her cousin Mary. She was tiny. Yet Mary Jane, showing some of her mother's spirit, rose above the challenges she faced. "It was really remarkable," said Mary, "that she was able to hold down her job because she was so small. She was very sweet as an adult. Everyone liked her. We tried to invite her to all the functions of the family because, of course, she had no one." When Mary Jane received the request from CHR, she considered it carefully and then wrote back. "I have really developed a lot of medical problems," she told her doctors. "I realize now that most of them are probably a result of my mother's illness. If it is convenient and you wish me to do so, I would like to come up to Argonne Lab. I feel it is important for myself and for research." It seems Mary Jane was tested, adding her own contribution to science. On August 16, 1984, she gave permission to the researchers to exhume her mother. "If this could help one person," she said, "it is worth it." And so, on October 2, 1984, Catherine Donahue left St. Columba Cemetery for an unexpected journey. The scientists ran their tests, and she made her unique endowment to medical knowledge. Catherine was reinterred on August 16, 1985, where she rests to this day beside her husband, Tom. When Mary Jane wrote to CHR, she said, in an uncanny echo of her mother's final letter to Father Keane, "I pray all the time that God will let me live a long life. I certainly try hard enough to fight all the time for a life of fulfillment and happiness." But it was not to be. After a life full of physical challenges, Mary Jane Donahue died from heart failure, according to her relatives, on May 17, 1990. She was 55 years old. For a long time, too long, the legacy of the Radium Girls was recorded only in the law books and in scientific files. But in 2006, an eighth-grade Illinois student called Madeline Piller read a book on the dial painters by Dr. Ross Mulner. "No monuments," he wrote, "have ever been erected in their memory." Madeline was determined to change that. "They deserve to be remembered," she said. "Their courage brought forth federal health standards. I want people to know there is a memorial to these brave women." When she began to champion her cause, she found that Ottawa, at last, was ready to honor its native heroines and their comrades in arms. The town held fish fry fundraisers and staged plays to secure the $80,000 needed. "The mayor was supportive," said Len Grossman. "It was a complete turnaround. That was wonderful to see." On September 2nd, 2011, the bronze statue for the dial painters was unveiled by the governor in Ottawa, Illinois. It is a statue of a young woman from the 1920s with a paintbrush in one hand and a tulip in the other, standing on a clock face. Her skirt swishes as though at any moment she might step down from her time-ticking pedestal and come to life. "The Radium Girls," the governor announced, "deserve the utmost respect and admiration because they battled a dishonest company, an indifferent industry, dismissive courts, and the medical community in the face of certain death. I hereby proclaim September 2nd, 2011, as Radium Girls Day in Illinois, in recognition of the tremendous perseverance, dedication, and sense of justice the Radium Girls exhibited in their fight." "If Marie saw that memorial down there today," said Marie Rossiter's daughter-in-law, "she wouldn't believe it. When I go downtown and I go past, I say, 'Well, Marie, they finally did something.' If she was alive today to see the statue, she would have said, 'About time.'" The statue is dedicated not only to the Ottawa dial painters, but also to dial painters who suffered all over the United States. This bronze radium girl, forever young, forever present, stands for Grace Fryer and Catherine Schaub, for the Maggia and Carlo sisters, for Hazel and Irene and Ella, too. She stands for all the dial painters, whether they lived and died in Orange, in Ottawa, in Waterbury, or anywhere else. It is a fitting and most deserving memorial. After all, there is so much to thank the women for. "The studies of the radium dial workers," wrote Dr. Ross Mulner, "form the basis of much of the world's present knowledge of the health risks of radioactivity. The suffering and deaths of these workers greatly increased scientific knowledge, ultimately saving countless lives of future generations. I always admired their strength," said Catherine Donahue's great-niece, "to stand up and unite." And, united, they triumphed. Through their friendships, through their refusal to give up, and through their sheer spirit, the Radium Girls left us all an extraordinary legacy. They did not die in vain. They made every second count. Postscript. "We girls," said one worker, "would sit around big tables, laughing and talking and painting. It was fun to work there." "I felt lucky to have a job there," revealed another girl. The job paid top dollar for women in this area. All of us got along real good. We slapped the radium around like cake frosting. The women wore smocks, washed once a week amidst the family laundry. They drank open cans of soda through their shifts, sourced from the machine in their studio. They worked with bare hands and painted their fingernails with the material for kicks. They were allowed to take radium home to practice painting. There was radium everywhere in the plant and outside on the sidewalk. Contaminated rags piled up in the workrooms or were burned outside in the yard. Radioactive waste was emptied into the toilet of the men's washroom. Ventilation shafts discharged above a nearby children's play area. The women didn't clean their shoes before they left work, so they walked the radium all over town. Employees recalled that you couldn't work in the plant without getting covered with the stuff. I'd come home from work at night and look in the mirror and see little specks of it glowing in my hair, recalled one dial painter. The women's hands would bleed as they tried to scrub away the supernatural shine. The company, said one girl, always led us to believe everything was under control and safe, but I don't think they cared. She was right. Before too long, the workers started suffering. I had to have a mouth operation, said one, but now my teeth are so loosened that they are probably all going to fall out. I have a blood disease I can't seem to get rid of. The women noticed tumors appearing on their feet, their breasts, their legs. One woman recalled that the doctors kept cutting off parts of her colleague's leg, bit by bit by bit, until finally there was nothing more left to amputate. Ruth, the colleague, eventually died. The women went to their supervisor, worried sick. A man from the New York headquarters came out here, a radium girl remembered, and told us our work wouldn't hurt us. Breast cancer, said the executive, is thought to be a hormonal problem, not a radioactivity hazard. But he was mistaken. A National Cancer Institute specialist observed that the link between breast cancer and radiation was one of the best established relationships around. The executive continued to bluster. The plant manager isn't entirely to blame. Employees are responsible for safety, too. But there were no warning signs in the workrooms. The women had been told that, as long as they didn't lip point, they would be perfectly safe. These women worked in a little town called Ottawa, Illinois. These women worked for Joseph Kelly's firm, Luminous Processes. The year was 1978. The original radium girls were indeed Cassandra-like in their powers, and just like Cassandra, their prophecies were not always listened to. Safety standards only keep you safe if the companies you work for use them. Concerns had been raised about the Ottawa plant for decades, but it wasn't until February 17, 1978, that the dangerous studio was finally shut down. Inspectors found radiation levels were 1,666 times higher than was safe. The abandoned building became something of a boogeyman for Ottawa residents, who became afraid to walk or even drive past it. It was graffitied with the slogan, "Dial Luminous for Death." "A lot of us are dead," one LP dial painter stated bluntly. Of 100 workers she mentioned, 65 had died. The cancer rate was twice as high as normal. Yet, Luminous Processes was unapologetic. It wriggled out of paying cleanup costs, contributing approximately $62,000, $147,500, to the multi-million dollar bill, while executives used double talk to put off the women when they demanded answers. Workers were offered just $100, $363 in severance pay and had difficulty suing the firm. They didn't have any respect for the health of the girls, one LP worker spat. They were just interested in getting the work out. Luminous processes, declared the local paper, seems to put profits before people. How quickly we forget. Author's note. I first discovered the story of the Radium Girls when I directed Melanie Marnich's beautiful play about the Ottawa women, These Shining Lives, in the spring of 2015 in London. It is a show that is rarely performed in the UK, but I randomly found it by Googling Great Plays for Women. And while I may have been British and living more than 4,000 miles from the town at the center of the script, the instant I read Catherine Donohue's opening monologue, I knew it was a story I needed to tell. This incredible piece of history, showcasing real women standing up for their rights with strength, dignity, and courage, was universal in its power and resonated with me hugely. I firmly believe that when you're entrusted to tell someone else's true story, whether as an author, actor, or director, you have a responsibility to do justice to those whose story it is. That's how I approached the true tale of the Radium Girls from that very first moment I discovered it. Consequently, I set about preparing for my production by conducting a lot of background research, including reading everything I could find on the women. At that time, this largely comprised two excellent academic books, Radium Girls, Women and Industrial Health Reform, 1910 to 1935 by Claudia Clark, and Dr. Ross Mulner's Deadly Glow, The Radium Dial Worker Tragedy. These books were full of valuable information which enabled my cast and me to tell the girls' story with authenticity. Yet, as a storyteller and a non-academic, I was struck by the fact that the books focused on the legal and scientific aspects of the women's story and not on the compelling lives of the girls themselves. In fact, I soon discovered that no book existed that put the Radium Girls center stage and told the story from their perspective. The individual women who had fought and died for justice had been eclipsed by their historic achievements. They were now known only by the anonymous moniker of the Radium Girls. Their unique experiences, their losses and their loves, their triumphs and their terrors, had been forgotten, if ever charted in the first place. I became determined to correct that omission. Through directing the play, the women had become precious to me, and I wanted to showcase their shining spirits in a book that would tell their story, not just the story of the famous professionals who had helped them. These were ordinary, working-class women, and I aimed to chart their journey. From the joy of their first lucrative paycheck, through the first aching tooth, to the courage each girl had to find inside herself in order to fight back against the employer who had poisoned her. I wanted to walk in step with the women and describe each moment as though it was happening here and now. I hoped that, in this way, readers would be able to engage with the twists and turns of this decades-old history and to empathize with the individual Radium Girls. I wanted the women to feel like friends. Naturally, I was mindful of a key responsibility to do justice to the girls' true story. As an author, that responsibility took me 4,000 miles across an ocean to follow in the Radium Girls' footsteps in America. I wanted to walk their routes to work and visit their homes and graves. I wished to trace the path between the Maggia sisters' houses and appreciate how difficult it must have been to manage the steep, sloping hill with a radium-induced limp. In writing the book, I was driven by a desire to give the girls a distinctive voice, so I was also looking for clues and for the records they themselves had left behind, which would enable me to represent them. Stunningly, my research uncovered their genuine words. Through their diaries, letters, and court testimonies, the girls had personally left behind their own accounts of what had happened to them. Their voices had been there all along, gathering dust in the archives, just waiting for someone to listen. As I delved deeper and deeper into their lives, I felt as though I became their representative, championing them 100 years on, a facilitator allowing their own story finally to take flight. My research began in New Jersey, but it also took me to Washington, D.C., Chicago, and, of course, to Ottawa, Illinois, too. To stand on the site of Radium Dial and to realize that Catherine's beloved church was diagonally opposite really brought home how much the radium companies were truly at the heart of their communities and how hard it was for the women to fight back. Meanwhile, standing in front of Catherine's house, where she had lived and died, the same house described in that riveting opening monologue of Marnich's play, felt nothing short of iconic. And I was lucky enough to interview the women's relatives, too, to find out what the heroines of my book were really like. Some descendants were fairly easy to trace, having spoken out previously in interviews with their local newspapers. But others, including the family of Catherine Donahue, I had to track down through old-fashioned research. To her credit, when Catherine's great-niece received a random email at her workplace from a strange English woman asking if we could meet to discuss her long-dead relative, she was gracious, generous, and helpful. In truth, all the relatives I spoke to were. Universally, they were pleased that the story was being told in this way at last, and in their interviews shared the tiny, personal details that brought the women to life in the book. One of the most moving interviews was with Catherine's niece, Mary. When I asked if Catherine had ever cried out with the pain, Mary's recollection that her aunt had had no energy to scream, but could only moan, was particularly haunting. The families also shared childhood photographs of their aunts, sisters, and mothers. One photograph I found especially touching was of an 8-year-old Peg Looney with her grandmothers and mother. The three generations standing side by side suggested a legacy and a future that they confidently believed would stretch well into the 20th century. Little did they know that legacy would be cut short 15 years later with Peg's premature death from radium poisoning. As well as conducting personal interviews and on-site research, I also spent days poring over dusty letters and yearbooks in libraries and scanning through the microfilmed records of lawyers, doctors, and newspapers. Time and again, I was moved to tears as I read through the details of the women's suffering and appreciated how real this whole story was, as I learned of the constricting plaster cast Quinta McDonald had to wear from her diaphragm to her knees, as I saw Molly Maggia's x-rays, her bones shining white on black, as I held in my bare hands Catherine Donahue's final correspondence with her friend Pearl Payne, knowing that I was touching the same paper Catherine herself once had. However, the aspect of my research that truly brought home the reality of what the Radium Girls endured was my series of visits to their graves. I was escorted there by their families, on separate occasions, and they stood respectfully a short distance away as I crouched down to touch the granite stones and pay my respects. Seeing the women's names engraved on those headstones, knowing that their beleaguered bodies lay beneath the sunlit grass, was a sobering reminder that they deserved to be remembered for their sacrifice. Once I was back home in England, I knew I had a duty to do my best by them, as I tried to bring their story to life. So I took them with me, as well as I could. I wrote the book with pictures of the women displayed around my desk. I said good morning to their faces every day. I locked eyes with them as I wrote about Grace's death, about Catherine's battle to stay alive for her children. Those photographs entwined in my mind with my vivid memories of their hometowns, as well as with their families' recollections and the knowledge I had gained of them in the archives. I charted each woman's individual journey, feeling with her the highs and lows of the fateful path that lay ahead, the desperate hope for a cure, the grief of a miscarriage, the determination to fight on no matter what. Time and again, I was astonished by the girl's bravery and spirit in the face of unbelievably tragic suffering. 8-year-old Peg Looney was one of those keeping me company as I wrote, and I hope, through my book, that the legacy she and her mother and grandmothers had innocently anticipated stretching through the years has, in a way, come to be after all. I am writing now in the 21st century, and because of the remarkable sacrifice of Peg and her friends, they are still remembered. In this way, the Radium Girls live on, shining through the darkness of history to blaze a light for good, for strength, and for courage. It has been an enormous honor to play a small part in helping them to do that. In the end, this book belongs to them. I simply hope that I have done them justice. Kate Moore, London, 2017. This has been a Highbridge production. Read by Angela Brazil. Copyright 2017 by Kate Moore. Published by arrangement with Source Books Incorporated. Recording copyright 2017 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.